25. Kamran struggled in vain. It was not in his nature to give in under attack, and he could not bring himself, even immobilized as he was, to simply let go. His mind thrashed against the injustice of it all, against the breakdown of his life. Ardunia had been his to inherit from the moment he could form conscious thought. This was his home, his land. These were his people. And no matter his many qualms, and no matter the complaints he'd so often registered aloud, Kamran did not want to lose who he was. Even he, at this miserable juncture, could admit now that there was perhaps some truth to Zahak's remonstrations. Kamran had been a spoiled child. He'd taken his life for granted. He saw that now. But never again would he be a child, and never again would he be cosseted. He'd been forced, unfinished, into this blistering kiln of change, and it had vulcanized him. It would continue to transform him. He could learn from his mistakes. He could adapt, as the situation demanded, and he did not want to lose his crown. He listened for a moment to the sound of footfalls echoing through the corridor, the back of Zahak's greasy head leading the way as they went. The trio of diviners were close behind, and Kamran knew this only because he could feel them there, their presence as palpable as the cloak that still draped his body. Mercifully, the prince could move his eyes, and he was able to follow the path they forged through the endless halls of his home, which meant he soon realized, with mounting dread, that they were heading to the throne room. The inevitable was finally upon him. The prince was about to be dragged before a team of nobles who would flay him with their castigations, only to then force him before a halo of diviners who would perform a ceremony that would strip him of his birthright. On top of everything else he'd endured these last 24 hours, this seemed a bridge too far. He felt something break in his chest, something hollowing in the region of his heart. In a single day, he had been decimated. Even as it killed him to imagine it, Kamran held fast to a single hope, that after they ruined him tonight, he might still have time enough to dash to the docks to meet Hazan. He was worrying over this, clinging now more than ever to the idea that, in the wake of his metamorphosis, he might at least become his own man, avenge his grandfather's death, and forge his own path, when, at a sudden split in the passage, Zahak took a sharp left, and Kamran veered right. A fresh wave of unease moved through him. He couldn't turn his head to see for certain, but he had to assume the diviners were behind this abrupt change in plan. He was now going in an entirely different direction from the defense minister, and it was a minute before he heard Zahak's surprised shout, his distant footfalls growing louder as he chased them down. Kamran heard the minister's voice as if through water. "Where are you going?" came his dull, warped cry. "You're meant to follow me to the throne room. We're all prepared." "Not tonight," said a diviner. They never stopped moving. Hope took flight in the prince's heart, shook him from within. He had no idea where they were headed now, but this seemed a promising turn of events. "What do you mean?" Zahak said, his muted voice shaking with anger. "We had a plan. You agreed to perform the ceremony tonight."
"We agreed only to test the boy," came the simple reply.
"Test him? Test him how? Wait! You can't go back on your word. You're incapable of lying."
"We promised to determine whether the boy is fit to rule."
"There's no question but that he's unfit," cried Zahak. "The boy is mutilated. That has to mean something. The magic has clearly made a statement."
"Leave," said the diviners in unison.
The word was spoken softly, but it hit Zahak with a forceful gust.
knocking him back several feet and keeping him there. The defense minister fought in vain against this unrelenting wind, crying out as they retreated. Kamran's heart was pounding dangerously fast, for the hope that had so recently burgeoned in his chest had quickly evaporated. We agreed only to test the boy. The prince hadn't a single reasonable hypothesis for what might happen next, and he didn't have much time to theorize. Once Zahak had been left behind, the diviners propelled him through the castle at a breakneck speed, moving so swiftly the scenes around him blurred, so he had no idea of their location and could not guess at where they might be headed. His only clue arrived when he felt himself growing dizzy, and he realized as his head spun that they were spiraling upward, climbing floors. Of all the hints he might have received, this one was by far the darkest, for he knew most assuredly then that they were ascending the palace spires, and there was nothing good to be found here. Still, he told himself not to overreact until he knew more, until he could be sure. They came to a sudden disorienting stop outside of an ominous, heavily rusted door, which blew open at the diviner's behest, and Kamran began to panic. When he felt the icy air of the merciless winter night rush all around him, his panic wedded with horror. This was the Tower Prison. Infinitely worse than the dungeons, which were only temporary holding cells, the Tower Prisons were reserved for the worst transgressors, usually high-ranking criminals who required more time to be sentenced, and were in the interim doomed to wait out this period in the harshest form of solitary confinement, to make certain they didn't escape. Keeping prisoners was an exhausting, grueling, and inefficient business. His grandfather had never cared for it. He'd always encouraged Kamran to deal with criminals swiftly. Once a judgment had been made, the punishment would be served and the prisons cleared out. Inmates were, as a result, never kept for very long, and the worst of them were often beheaded shortly thereafter. They hadn't used the Tower Prisons in years. Even Kamran, who was fairly stout of heart, shook inwardly at the thought of such a fate. How the diviners intended to test him with this experience he couldn't know, and what he'd done to deserve this level of cruelty he couldn't imagine. He only hung there, suspended in the doorway of his disgusting new home, for the length of a truly terrifying moment. It was pitch black, but for the glimmer of the moon and stars, for the tower had a single open-air skylight, which loomed from on high, at least 50 feet above his head. He had no idea what carcasses he might be forced to share this room with, and it made him ill to imagine he might leave this place only to have his head removed from his body. Fear awoke, untamed, inside his mind. How was this wretched place meant to prove his mettle? If only he could speak aloud a single word then, he would have begged for quarter. "Why?" he wanted to shout. "Why are you doing this? What have I done to deserve such a sentence?" Alas! Kamran hadn't more than a moment to process this tyranny before his body was shuttled into the cell, the door slammed shut behind him, and he was finally, unceremoniously, released. He fell to the icy stone floor with a pitiful cry. 26. Cyrus still clung to her, his cheek pressed heavily against her chest. But his effort to transport them appeared to have drained the dregs of his energy, for he'd fallen asleep once more. He did not stir, he said not a word, and she could feel his deep, even breaths against her skin. Inch by agonizing inch, she drew away from him, carefully disentangling their limbs. He resisted at first, making incoherent sounds of protest, but he soon accepted his empty arms, even as he frowned in his sleep. She watched him shift a bit, trying to get comfortable, and soon his hand slid up the silk sheet of his pillow, just as he'd done with her leg. A rush of air left her lungs. Perhaps her overwrought nerves could finally recover. They were safely back in the palace. Cyrus was in bed. He no longer seemed to be in danger of kissing her. And now all she had to do was sneak out and slink back to her own quarters, which was much easier said than done, for this palace was enormous and terrifyingly vertiginous. Aliza had no idea where her rooms were positioned relative to his, but compared with all else, this seemed a simple enough problem to solve. First, she'd need to figure out how to exit Cyrus's room without notice, and then she'd have to make certain to avoid running into Sara, who'd no doubt want to discuss Aliza's progress on the path to murdering her son. Should she manage all this, Aliza would only need to ask a few nosy gossiping servants for directions to her room, all the while hoping the uninitiated among them would neither question who she was nor ask about the bloodstain on her skirt. Simple. With a quiet groan, she surreptitiously slid off the bed, but then, glancing back at Cyrus, she hesitated. She knew better than to think his intoxicated actions tonight were indicative of some larger shift in their relationship. Cyrus had told her quite plainly just hours ago that he hated her, and the Noster had confirmed this. They'd enjoyed some reluctant and surprising moments of friendship, but she didn't think it was enough to erase such passionate feelings of loathing, not when the agreement between them was meant to end with murder. Still, Aliza was too reasonable to deny that, despite her many practical objections, she was intensely aware of Cyrus. There was no questioning that she felt a baffling magnetic pull between their bodies. Then again, that didn't mean she trusted him. And right now, she feared for him. For 2 hours, the devil had put him through 7 levels of hell, and apparently it wasn't his first time. She doubted it would be the last. And while she knew Iblis had taken notice of her concern for Cyrus, she felt there was nothing to be done for it. Aliza didn't see the effectiveness in pretending to reverse what had already been set in motion. The devil was not stupid. She would never be convincing enough to trick him into thinking otherwise. Aliza did care. Ice ran through her veins, yes, but it had never made her cold-hearted. She'd sat there and borne witness to Cyrus's suffering. She'd cried for him. And now, no matter the devil's machinations, no matter the incomprehensible state of things between she and the perplexing king, Aliza was too tender-hearted to abandon his battered, brutalized body without a touch of mercy. With a sigh, she walked over to his side of the bed, studying his strained expression, the dried blood caking his garments. Cyrus still wore his boots, his sword belt, his dense black coat. She saw the glimmer of a sheathed blade resting heavily against his leg, and knew he must be terribly uncomfortable. Gone was the softness in his face, earlier rendered by sleep. He'd been grumpy since she'd pulled away from him, and his shoulders had tensed all over again, even in slumber. When she closed her eyes, she still saw him bleeding. She could hear him weep. Gently, she drew her hand along the vamp of one sleek, black boot, the craftsmanship of the maker displayed in every inch of the buttery leather. With careful movements, she tugged up the hem of Cyrus's dark trousers until she uncovered a swath of warm, golden skin dusted with his coppery hair. Focusing her eyes on the buckle she'd sought out, she unfastened the boot easily, then slid the supple article free from his socked foot, also black. Aliza took the heavy boot into her hand and examined it, helpless to admire the careful, even stitches, the evidence of hours and hours of hard labour, even as she set it down. She repeated the process once more on his other foot, and once done, she placed the sturdy pair neatly against the wall. Then, delicately, she drew one of Cyrus's arms away from his pillow and gingerly tugged it free of its coat sleeve. She intended to roll him onto his alternate side, hoping to replicate the action on his other arm, when he suddenly jolted. He drew a violent breath and sat up like a springy child's toy, startled just as he'd been in the flower field. This time, however, Aliza knew what to expect. She knew he wasn't truly awake, and she would avoid being drawn into ephemeral conversations with him. She doubted he'd remember much of this.
Aliza!
He blinked blearily, studying her with red, glassy eyes. There was a desperation in his voice when he said,
"Why did you leave me?"
His words were like a shot to the heart. With effort, she pushed aside this aching sensation, knowing that what he'd provoked in her was the work of a ghost. Never would she have expected an uninhibited version of Cyrus to be so emotional or affectionate. But then, she didn't actually know what she was dealing with, or what exactly he was going through. Whatever it was, this was not the real Cyrus.
"Will you help me?" she said instead. "I was trying to take off your coat."
He said nothing, just looked at her, then at himself, partly divested of his jacket. In stark, childlike motions, he removed the rest of the article, then shoved the garment half-heartedly away from himself. It toppled with a slithering sound to the floor. Aliza promptly scooped this up into her arms, surprised by its weight, and draped it carefully on the back of a nearby chair. She turned around just in time to see Cyrus ripping off his shirt. Like dew in winter, she froze. He'd pulled the dark article up over his head, his face disappearing as his naked upper body came suddenly, shockingly into view, and Aliza, who'd not realized how she was staring, did not stir until she heard the ragged sound of her own breathing. Good God! Cyrus was powerful. She didn't know how else to describe the sight of him, stripped down to his skin. She didn't know how to fathom into words the corded muscle that moved as he stretched, the sinewy lines of his body that snaked all the way down his torso. He gleamed in the soft light, the shadows carving him into a wonder so substantial she was disturbed by a sudden stupid desire to touch him, to see what he might feel like under her hand. Cyrus paid her no attention. He pulled the shirt free, his hair suffering in the aftermath, and let the garment fall where it fell, not seeming to care for its fate. Aliza watched him in a daze as he moved, riveted by the motions of his arms as he unbuckled his sword belt, marvelling at the tension in the muscles flexing across his body, the tightly restrained power behind even his slightest movements. He let the precious holster and its weapon fall to the ground with a clatter, and Aliza, who'd been in something of a trance, nearly jumped a foot in the air at the sound. But it was when he began unbuttoning his trousers that she turned sharply around with a stifled cry, covering her entire face with her hands. Oh, she was ashamed of herself. She'd been gawking at him brazenly, like an unprincipled deviant, her heart beating like the wings of a hummingbird, so fast it was making her feel ill. Heavens, but she'd forgotten herself. She was not an unprincipled deviant. She did not ogle the naked bodies of men under the influence of dark magic.
Aliza? She heard him say.
She made an effort to moderate her voice, but did not turn around.
Yes?
Alice, he said again, this time softly scolding.
Are you? She said tremulously. Are you decent?
She heard the low rumble of his laugh.
Yes.
Terrified, she turned around in slow motion. She discovered him still sitting up, but was relieved beyond reason to find that he'd pulled the blanket around his lower body.
Hello, she whispered, lifting a hand in greeting like the veriest idiot.
He only looked at her in response, looked at her with manifest desire, his gaze darkening as he watched her, like he wanted to devour her. His eyes raked her face and body until she felt a liquid heat roil through her, tension coiling taut in her stomach. She took an unsteady step back.
Come here, he said roughly.
No, she said, shaking her head. I can't. Cyrus, you're very tired.
She watched his chest expand as he breathed, his eyes closing even as he fought it.
I want you, he said, weakening in that familiar sudden manner. Next to me.
I'll come back, she lied, her heart pounding in her ears. You rest here until I return.
He rolled his neck, stretching tense muscles as he sighed. He sank down a few inches, his head perilously close to his pillow.
Alisa,
he whispered, even as his lashes fluttered, his exhaustion proving unconquerable.
Don't lie to me.
She said nothing to this, not knowing how to respond. She only clasped her hands tightly against her stomach, feeling herself tying ever more tightly into knots. Finally, like slowly sinking sediment, Cyrus's heavy body succumbed. He slid with a soft hush against his sheets, his head hitting the soft down of his pillow. He did not lift his weary arms to draw the blanket above his shoulders, but here was where Aliza walked away. For the truth was, she'd reached her limit the moment Cyrus had removed his shirt. She swallowed. It wasn't right to be so attracted to a man she was meant to kill. Besides, Cyrus had no idea what he was doing. He was out of his head, his common sense dimmed by something dangerous. If he had any idea of the things he'd said to her, if he had any idea how he'd been acting around her, just then came a sharp knock at the door. Aliza bit back a shriek, her heart resuming its desperate pounding. She heard the soft call of a maid's voice, asking for leave to enter, and looked desperately at Cyrus, who didn't stir. The servant called out again. Aliza knew what happened next. She'd been that snodder. For a brief window in the evening, during which time the occupants of a house were expected to be downstairs for dinner, a servant would come into a room to stoke the fire, refresh the linens, and attend to small tasks. The protocol was to ask permission thrice, waiting each time for a response, before accepting silence as tacit consent to cross the threshold. One more knock, and the snodder would enter the room. The maid would almost certainly have a heart attack, and worry dearly for her job once she discovered the undressed king lying in his bed. But it would be at least a minute or two before the snodder reached this chamber, Aliza was realizing. For Cyrus, as sovereign, likely lived in the largest and most opulent wing in the castle. There had to be at least several large rooms between the bedchamber and the entrance, which meant she might have just enough time to hide. Frantically, she whipped around. Angels above! If she were discovered in the king's bedchamber, if she were even discovered in his rooms, the scandal would no doubt disseminate through the empire in under an hour. She'd either be expected to marry him or be denounced as a harlot. Either way, the repercussions would horribly complicate her life. Aliza had learned her lesson this afternoon.
There were djinn working in this palace, and not only were they ready and eager to spread news about her, but she couldn't rely on her invisibility to help her now, for those efforts worked only on clay eyes. Perhaps if she found Cyrus's dressing room, she might hide in his closet. But when she heard the door open a moment later, her mind went blank. She bolted down the hall and yanked open the first door she could find.
27. The night was blistering.
Kamran clambered to his feet and dusted off his cloak, taking a moment to calibrate after having been so incapacitated, and only moments later he was shivering. The stone floor underfoot was icy in places, frost having recently chased the rain. The silence was serrated by the devoted chitter of crickets, occasionally stirred by the hoot of a hunting owl. Terrible gusts howled and battered the tower skylight, the wind not knowing how to navigate the narrow opening. Kamran looked up. This small distant window, he was realizing, was both a blessing and a cruelty in this dire place, for while it provided what was no doubt a welcome light during the day, it also exposed its prisoner to the elements at night, proving to Kamran once again that pleasure and torture were often delivered in the same blow. It made him think of Aliza. It was impossible not to think of her then, to be reminded of the linchpin of the tragic story that had become his life. Aliza, who'd awoken in him emotion he'd never before experienced, who'd opened his eyes to a kind of glorious madness he hadn't even known was possible, and then with a tender smile so delicately snapped in half his entire world. She'd risen up from dust, come to life on a breeze, and left a trail of perfumed flowers in her wake as she ushered in the fall of a king who'd ruled the greatest empire on earth for nearly a century. The true wonder was how she'd done it, without lifting a finger, without even raising her voice. She'd simply stood tall, and his world had collapsed. She spoke, and the diviners had been slaughtered. She spun, and his grandfather had been murdered. She laughed, and his body had been disfigured. She breathed, and his mother had vanished. She sighed, and his aunt no longer spoke to him. She left, and his own people had turned on him. Kamran could not even hear her name without taking it like a shot to the chest. Even then, he wondered whether he'd ever see her again. With great effort, he forced himself to clear his mind of her, and as his gut twisted, he felt a quiet gratitude for the icy chill that braced him, for it was an excruciating blessing. This cold was likely the only reason Kamran could breathe through the stench of his revolting cell. He was afraid even to move, for his foot had a moment ago brushed against a soft heap of what had to be a stock of dead animals. The feathered among them he could not explain, but the furrier beasts, whose carcasses littered this floor, had no doubt fallen to their deaths from the lip of the skylight. He supposed he'd know more about his rotting inmates upon sunrise. Until then, he was left with only the curse of his imagination, for it painted him a terrifying picture of his days ahead. Still, he was not without a sliver of hope. For some perplexing reason, the diviners had not stripped him of his weapons before locking him in the tower, and he wondered whether he might not in daylight be able to use his daggers to scale the stone wall. He could perhaps wedge his blades between bricks bit by bit, carefully levering himself up the steep incline. It would place an excruciating demand upon his body, one he wasn't sure he was capable of, but even the possibility of escape granted his lungs the necessary inch they needed to expand, and finally he was able to draw breath. If only he could survive this brutal winter night, he might overcome this.
He would break this tower apart, brick by brick, if he had to. He would not be left here to rot. He would not be dragged from this pit to an unjust execution. He swore this to himself. And then he wondered, as he shouldered the weight of his present failure, how long Hazan would wait for him at the docks tonight before giving up. He wondered whether anyone would ever realize where he'd gone. It was then, as he had this grim thought, that he seemed suddenly able to hear them, or hear something, anyway. The sounds of the world around him dimmed in a disorienting, unnerving sea change. A hush soon filled his head in incremental, staticky fits and starts. This warbling birth of sound and vibration generated as if from nowhere, and which haunted him then in that eerie darkness. The white noise evolved into whispers that stroked cold fingers along the inside of his head, making him want to tear his skin from his body. The soft tremors grew steadily louder, crawling forth from an unformed, senseless hush into a swarm of voices that clamoured in his eardrums, attacking him with a forceful resonance, shouting and fighting to be heard all at once. Kamran clapped his hands over his ears, falling hard on one knee as his head exploded.
"Have any idea that the nobles were reconsidering his right to the throne? How cruel, and in the wake of his grandfather's murder."
"I don't know, miss. His grandfather wasn't a very good person."
"Oh, I only meant that it must be hard for him, you know, to deal with all these revelations."
"Where is it? I know you know where it is, and I demand you tell me."
"I can't believe I'm helping you, hooligans. I was supposed to be at home hours ago."
"Kamran, you idiot. What have you gotten yourself into now?"
"Come along then, pet. Thank you for telling me."
"Can't just leave him in there. Omid, do you remember which way they turned after that?"
"Already searched the king's rooms. I couldn't find it."
"At least that horrid housekeeper is no longer with us."
"Yes, miss. I followed them all the way up."
"Didn't see you. How did you manage that?"
"A long time, sir. Being a street child means learning how to disappear in plain sight, and I..."
"Hazan!"
"Oh, thank goodness you're here."
"Why are you protecting him? Where did you take him? Why are you willfully jeopardizing the future of this empire?"
"The hell are you two doing here?
And aren't you the apothecarist? Your cloak weighs heavy tonight, sire." "Yes, I'm an apothecarist. Who are you?"
"Saving the prince."
"It's my duty to assume control of the throne. You must tell me where it is. It's my right. It's my..."
"You should turn out your pockets, child, and unburden yourself."
"What have you done with it? Where did you put it?"
"Turn out your pockets, child. Turn them out. Turn out your pockets. Do it now."
With a rising, whistling shriek that nearly took off his head, the voices were suddenly ripped out of his mind, leaving in their absence only a lingering scream that all but blew out his eardrums. Kamran was on both knees now, fighting back a cry of agony as his chest heaved and his head ached and his ears rung painfully as the sounds of the world slowly regenerated around him. He soon heard the trill of crickets, the call of a night bird, the wind sweeping a scatter of dead leaves toward his feet. Still, he struggled to regain his strength. In the aftermath of this strange episode, Kamran was left shaking, his limbs trembling. He felt an unexpected warmth of moisture at his ear and lifted an unsteady hand to inspect it, his fingers coming away smeared with blood. Kamran's heart was pounding. He didn't understand what had just happened, but he was aware enough to fuse together what seemed the most likely theory, that this experience could only have been crafted through the use of magic, which meant the diviners must have been trying to communicate with him. "Turn out your pockets." These cryptic words made no sense.
There was nothing in his pockets, save a bit of gold, Aliza's book, and his chainmail mask. And last he'd checked, none of these things was a sledgehammer, which was the only item he truly cared to possess at the moment. Nevertheless, he was too curious to ignore such a direct command, and he clumsily patted himself down, turning out his pockets, even as his head swam, his frozen fingers fumbling. The usual suspects were all here, all accounted for, and there was nothing else to... Kamran's hands stilled then, as he felt the shape of something unfamiliar in his interior cloak pocket. Carefully, blinking to clear his blurry vision, Kamran withdrew a small rectangular package from his pocket. It was a slim box wrapped in brown paper, tied with simple red twine. He recognized the gift at once, the significance hitting him with an astonishing blow. His understanding of the moment was indeed so powerful, so fiercely unsettling, that he felt his eyes prick with emotion. The late diviners had given this to him days ago. Before they'd been murdered, before his home had been invaded, before his grandfather had been killed, before he'd ever known the satin of Eliza's skin. It was because of this package that he'd arrived at all in the royal square. The diviners had summoned him for a visit that day, despite the fact that he'd never announced his return to Sitar. He'd awoken early to avoid the crowds that would inevitably swarm the streets, and was making his way to the diviners' quarters when he was stopped in his tracks at the sight of what he thought was a grown man about to murder a servant girl. This moment, it had changed the course of his entire life. Later, after the pandemonium had settled, and after the diviners had taken in the street child to care for him, Kamran had finally gone to see the priests and priestesses, to whom he still owed a visit. He'd checked in on the boy while he was there, but Kamran had been so distracted by the outcome of his infuriating meeting with Omid that he hadn't paid much attention to the gift the diviners had pressed into his hands on his way out the door. The prince, who'd been by then accustomed to receiving small gifts on occasion from both diviners and commoners alike, merely tucked the parcel into his cloak pocket, meaning to open it at a later, less chaotic moment. It had remained here ever since. Now he stared at it with shaking hands, but he did not delay any further in unwrapping this package. He tore it open like a crazed man, tossing the scraps to the filthy ground, and carefully lifted the delicate lid of a simple wooden box. A wisp of paper fluttered out at once, and which he caught in a desperate motion with his unbloodied hand. Then, his heart pounding in his chest, he looked inside the box, within which he discovered a single black feather resting in a bed of linen. At first, he did not understand. He scrambled to unfurl the paper, which he quickly held up to the moonlight, and in the distant glow, he was able to discern that the scrap was but a piece of a much larger document. It was a small slip of paper with torn edges, and its pale skin had been printed upon in the neat, careful script of his grandfather. It read, "Leave this feather to my grandson, to use only when all else seems lost, when his tragedies feel insurmountable and hope feels impossible. He will need only to touch it to his own blood, and Simorgh will come for him, as she once did for me. I also leave him my..." There the message was cut off, and Kamran's heart sped up to a truly frightening pace. Suddenly he could hear nothing but his own breaths, the harsh sounds echoing between his ears, his mind spinning as the world around him seemed to fracture and reassemble, fall apart and resurrect.
Still, he did not hesitate. Kamran pressed the feather into his blood-stained hand, and with a shaky, terrified breath, he closed his fist. In the beginning, one night was born a royal child. Windows shattered, the rain was wild. The queen rejoiced, the king ran inside. He looked at his son, his eyes went wide. The baby had hair the color of milk. His body was healthy, soft as silk. Still the father was frozen. He did nothing but stare at the white of his lashes and the white of his hair. "You've birthed an old man," was all he could say. "This child is cursed," and he tore him away. The mother then cried. The babe did too. He cried in the way babes often do. Amid protests and screams, that terrible king strapped the child to his back and did a terrible thing. He climbed a mountain, his arms growing stiff, left the baby to die at the top of a cliff. The wind was screaming, the child was too. He screamed in the way children often do, when their parent is vile and stupidity reigns, when delusion wins and intellect wanes. From on high watched a beast, who didn't like what she heard. Simorgh, Simorgh, a magnificent bird. Her heart was unmatched, her magic unknown. She snatched up the child to raise as her own. With four other chicks, the boy grew in her nest. He was happy and loved, and knew he was blessed. She warned him that one day he'd have to return to a life he'd not known, to a role he'd not learned. He rejected this warning, but Simorgh insisted. His destiny was written. It could not be resisted. News reached him one day that a woman still cried, that an empire was failing, that his father might die. Simorgh brought him finery that he wore without joy to return to the palace he'd not known as a boy. He said his farewells with an ache in his heart to the family he'd chosen, whom he'd loved from the start. Then he seated himself on his mother's back, and she tore through the sky with a deafening crack. Color exploded when she took flight. She landed at the palace in a shower of light. None would forget the day Zal had returned, the way the world brightened, the way his father had burned. Zal took the throne he was always meant to claim, but he would never forget his true mother's name. 28. Aliza was trying not to breathe. She dared not make a sound. She didn't even know where she was. In her panic, she'd not merely yanked open the closest door, she'd inadvertently broken it, shattering the lock with unplanned, wretched, preternatural strength. The hefty trio of engaged bolts had torn through the solid frame, and now the blasted door wouldn't latch. Her panic only escalated, and she feared that when the real Cyrus awoke, he'd renege on his promises and actually kill her for this appalling invasion of his privacy. She leaned heavily against the broken door, trying to catch her breath as she held the substantial panel closed. For the moment, at least, she was safe, for Aliza suspected the maid would know better than to poke her head in a chamber that was usually locked. Still, her mind was racing. She'd hardly had time to register that Cyrus kept a bolted room in his own private quarters before she'd been blindsided by its cozy interior. She realized only then, as she looked around, that she'd formed no expectations at all of Cyrus's personal tastes. He never wore anything but black. She'd not assumed he had any interest in color or comfort. and was stunned to discover that he'd hidden away such a beautifully appointed space. She stood then in a well-worn sitting room, anchored by a rug of astonishing detail, rendered in vivid shades of blue. The space itself was furnished with cosy lived-in seating, floor-to-ceiling shelves stocked with tattered books, and a titanic fireplace before which stood a colossal weathered desk stacked with papers, pots of ink, and various bell jars through which gleamed specimens of crystallized rock, each neatly labelled. There was so much to look at, she hardly knew where to rest her eyes. Her nerves calmed incrementally as she looked around, praying all the while that the room might present her with a secret exit, or a closet, or even an accessible window. Instead, she saw evidence of Cyrus everywhere. An empty cup of tea, a half-eaten apricot, and a slim leather volume with a visible bookmark sat together on a dusty end table, dozens and dozens of loose pages crammed with lines of steady, even script had been bound in twine and left stacked on one of the faded velvet couches. Aged yellow maps of terrains she didn't recognize had been annotated and pinned to the wall. A half-toppled tower of patterned rug pillows trembled beside a stack of unopened crates. A gleaming ox-headed mace rested against the slightly singed arm of a reading chair. A dark coat and a top hat hung from hooks adjacent to the fireplace. A bottle-green, thick-bristled hairbrush sat upon a low table beside a sleeve of long-stemmed matches and a solid bar of perfume. And there was a single brilliant sword, the gleaming copper blade of which had been planted into the wood floor beside the desk chair. Aliza wanted then, possibly more than she'd desired anything material in a long time, to open drawers, lift cushions, leaf through pages, and look around, even as she knew it would be treacherous to snoop. Nevertheless, she managed to restrain herself not because she was virtuous, but because if she stepped away from this door, it would yawn open and she couldn't risk. She heard a startled scream. Ah, the poor servant had discovered Cyrus then. Aliza heard the pounding of the Snodder's panicked footfalls as the girl bolted from the room with a terrified cry, and then, as the front door eased shut with an audible snick, her own petrified heart began pounding anew. It really hit her then. She had broken his door. She clapped a hand over her mouth, not knowing how she'd explain this. She couldn't hide the evidence of what she'd done, and she didn't know whether he'd believed the truth. From afar, she looked unambiguously guilty. Even she could see how it looked. Any who doubted her would assume she'd taken advantage of Cyrus's torture, and subsequent torpor, to trick the king into bringing her into his private rooms, whereupon she'd forced him into bed, only to then break down a locked door and rifle through his personal belongings. It made her seem fairly diabolical. She bit her lip. Such a story was false, of course, but she could not deny an urge to be just a little diabolical, for the desire to rummage through his things was agonizing. This room was a veritable museum of wonders, dotted not merely with fascinating artifacts of Cyrus's life, but with evidence of his state of mind, his current pursuits and interests. She felt certain there were answers here, clues to a series of mysteries she might otherwise never be able to solve. And then, with a start, she saw the cabinet. How she'd overlooked it initially she did not know, though perhaps because it was fairly unattractive, large, dark, weathered, and looming from its position against the wall adjacent to the fireplace. It was a sort of cabinet of curiosities, something more likely to be found in an apothecary than a sitting room, with many little doors and drawers, each with an individual keyhole. Temptation sunk its teeth in her. She drew inches deeper into the room, feet moving toward the chest, almost without her permission. The broken door groaned quietly open behind her, but she paid it no mind, for the maid was gone, the wing was quiet, and she felt quite certain Cyrus was asleep. She clasped her hands to keep from touching anything, but as she approached the cabinet, she felt her fingers flare with heat, proving a deliciously strange sensation for a girl with ice in her blood. The closer she drew, the more Aliza felt almost tethered to this odd piece of furniture, as if she were compelled to approach it, as if it contained something that belonged to her. Slowly the cabinet began to tremble. Aliza felt her pulse pick up and advanced toward the unit now with haste, the old wood rattling with increasing fervour. It was making a terrifying racket, the tremors so intense they disturbed the walls and floors of the entire room. She understood, dimly, that she would pay for causing such a clamour, that the din might wake Cyrus, that this could land her in a catastrophic amount of trouble. But at the moment, it seemed worth the risk. Aliza was transfixed. She drew a fortifying breath as she pressed her heated hands against the old shuddering exterior of the cabinet, the reverberations beginning to crescendo. She was waiting for something, even as she knew not what, and only when the vibrations had built up to the strength of a small earthquake did one of the small doors finally snap and swing open. Aliza hardly dared to breathe as she peeked into the deep, gleaming compartment, and in an instant her mind came unravelled. The heavy furniture had not ceased its shaking, the tumult growing only more frenzied, but Aliza found she no longer cared to be quiet. She wanted to scream. She felt betrayed and confused, her heart pounding wildly in her chest. Carefully she reached inside, her hand glowing so hot it hurt, and attempted to retrieve what was hers, what she'd worried she'd lost. And the door snapped shut so quickly it nearly took off her fingers. The cabinet went eerily still, and Cyrus, damn him, was fast. To be fair, Aliza had been preoccupied and the room had been rattling, but that he'd approached her with this degree of stealth, such that she'd not even sensed his presence, was truly impressive. She could not know how he'd done it. She had no idea what he'd seen or how, exactly, he'd spun her around and cornered her. She knew only that Cyrus was about to show her exactly why so much of the world feared him, for she was pinned against the wall and there was a sword pointed at her throat. "What?" he whispered, his eyes glittering with barely restrained fury. "Are you doing in here?" Even then, even when she'd begun to hate him again, when, his promises aside, she truly believed he'd not hesitate to kill her, even then she was relieved he'd managed to put on a pair of pants. He was not, however, wearing a shirt. Aliza dropped her gaze, stared at the blade. She was so much shorter than him that she could see her reflection in its shine. "Why," she said, lifting her eyes to his, "do you have my book?" He faltered at the murderous look on her face, his anger fracturing as warring instincts inside him fought for dominance. She could see his inner conflict, could see his twinge of remorse, even as his resentment percolated. Aliza was not without an imagination.
She saw why he might think she'd betrayed him when faced by ample evidence that she'd broken into his locked room, and she did not blame him for doubting her. How could she, when she understood how he felt? Of course he didn't know whether he could trust her, but neither did she know whether she could trust him. His blade was beginning to dig into her throat, and she worried for a moment that he might actually hurt her. "Cyrus," she said, "I asked you a question."
"I stole it," he said quietly.
The noster warmed against her chest.
"When?" she said, her heart failing. "Why?"
"Days ago," he said,
his halting whisper betraying his guilt. Still, he did not lower his weapon.
"I replaced it with a decoy enchanted to look identical."
"You went through my room at Bar's house," she said, astonished. "You searched my things."
"Yes."
"You lied to me."
"Technically," he said. "I did not."
"Don't you dare speak to me like you're an idiot," she said angrily, the blade cutting her just a little as she spoke. "You understand very well what I mean."
"Stop moving," he said, furious. "This sword is devastatingly sharp.
Then lower your weapon, you scoundrel."
He did, but only enough so it was no longer touching her.
"Are we back to this, then?"
He swallowed, staring at the cut at her neck.
"Insulting each other."
"You dare mourn the loss of my goodwill," she whispered, "even as you hold a blade to my throat."
"And you," he countered, his voice dropping an octave. "You have the audacity to rebuke me when I've discovered you doing the same detestable deed, breaking into my rooms to search my private belongings."
"I didn't mean to break the door."
"You chose to ransack my things," he cried. "Meanwhile, I was forced to rummage through yours."
Slowly, as if heavy cataracts were clearing her eyes, Aliza began to see what Sara saw. "It's not that I do not care," the woman had said. "It's that I no longer believe him. For the last several months, my son has blamed all his bad decisions on the devil. Never does he take accountability for his actions. He's always begging me to understand that he has no choice." Aliza felt suddenly, dangerously ill. She did not ask Cyrus how he'd done the hateful deed, for he'd accomplished things far more complicated than breaking into her unlocked, humble closet of a bedroom. It had likely taken him minutes to accomplish this trifling chore. She only stared at him then, her heart slowly atrophying in her chest. She ached at the betrayal, at her own stupidity, at her idiotic weaknesses that had led her to be kind to him. She hated herself for ever admiring him, for crying for him as he'd screamed, for mopping up his blood, and all but tucking him into bed. He'd bought her a piece of bread, and her charity had been so easily purchased, her porous heart so easily moved. She'd really thought perhaps they could be something like reluctant friends. Oh, she was a fool of astronomical proportions. He would never be on her side, she was realizing. No matter his occasional moments of humanity, Cyrus was in bed with the devil. Still, even as her heart hardened against him, she could not condemn him as Sara did. She'd seen what Iblis had done to him tonight, and she could not deny that Cyrus suffered greatly at the hands of his merciless master. But she reminded herself once more that Cyrus had summoned Iblis into his life. This copper-headed king had been offered something in exchange for his torment, and while she didn't know what he'd received or why he'd done it, she could not, by definition, call him a victim. Steadily she met his eyes. She saw an intensity in his stunning irises, something desperate, straining against his control, and she swore in that moment she could almost feel his soul pressing against hers. Even then, he was breathtaking.
Some quiet, foolish part of her wanted to rest her bones against his powerful body, feel the weight of his arms around her. She wanted to stroke his cheek one last time. "Cyrus," she said softly, "give me back my book, and I give you my word I won't hurt you." It seemed like an eternity before he said thickly, "I can't." The Noster flashed hot against her skin. "Very well." She lowered her eyes. "I just want you to know in advance how sorry I am. You've already been through so much tonight. I really don't want to do this."
"Aliza."
She moved in a flash, striking his sword arm before throwing a kick to his side in a rapid combination that briefly unbalanced him, even as his blade nicked her throat, drawing a thin line of blood. This she paid no mind, for she'd forced him to drop his arms a nanosecond, which was all she needed to knock the sword from his hand, after which she landed a hard kick to his chest, sending him stumbling across the room just long enough for her to lunge for the copper blade she'd earlier seen planted in the floor. She lifted this sword as she spun around and found Cyrus standing there, his own recovered weapon clenched in his right fist. With his free hand, he rubbed absently at the angry red mark she'd left on his heaving chest, looking at her with a fiery expression she couldn't decipher.
"You kicked me," he said angrily.
"You cut me," she countered. Something awoke in his eyes at that, a moment of misery there and gone, before he carefully lifted his blade, meeting her challenge. Quietly he said,
"Do you intend to fight me?"
"Are you going to prevent me from retrieving what is rightfully mine?" she asked, lifting her chin. "If so, yes."
"How did you even know it was here?" he asked, advancing slowly. "How did you know to come searching for it?"
"I had no idea it was here," she said indignantly. "I already told you I broke down your door by accident." He laughed darkly.
"And you snapped open the lock on my cabinet by accident, too?"
"I didn't even touch it. It opened on its own."
"What?"
He stopped moving.
"What do you mean?"
"Maybe you should first explain to me why you even have a locked cabinet inside of a locked chamber," she said angrily, "in your own locked wing of the castle."
"You ask this, even after you've destroyed my door?" he said, losing control of his temper. "It's obvious to me now that I should invest in even greater levels of protection, for there are demented djinn running around, breaking into my quarters and rifling through my things."
She gasped. "I am not a demented djinn. How dare you?"
"I am going to ask you one more time," he said, marshalling his patience, "to tell me how you knew it was here, Aliza."
"Or what?" she said. "Or you're going to kill me? I thought you weren't allowed to kill me." For some reason he flinched at that, awareness awakening in his eyes. He looked away, and Aliza wondered whether he was thinking of the devil, perhaps remembering his earlier encounter, except that his reaction was incongruent to the experience. Cyrus seemed weighed down suddenly, subdued by what looked suspiciously like grief.
"What do you mean?" he said, still staring at the floor. "That the cabinet door opened on its own?"
"I meant exactly what I said."
"But that's not possible."
He shook his head at the ground.
"The cabinet is heavily enchanted. You would have had to break the many tiers of security."
"That book," she said, incensed, "is mine. Mine by birth, by order of the earth. It knows me. I felt its presence when I approached the cabinet, and it unlocked itself to reach me. I did nothing but..."
"Unlocked itself?"
He looked up sharply.
"You mean it displayed some kind of power on its own?"
Aliza laughed then, finally understanding.
"Poor tormented Cyrus," she said, her voice softening. "All this time, you've been trying to make it animate, haven't you?"
"Yes."
"You will fail."
"Why?"
he said urgently.
"Why can't I open it?"
"Aren't you meant to wield great power?" she parroted back at him. "How is it you're so unschooled in the workings of magic?"
"Aliza!"
"More important, why would you think I'd ever tell you?"
Cyrus was breathing hard now, staring at her with something like desperation. He dropped his sword to the floor with a sudden terrifying clatter.
"Please, tell me."
"I will not," she said, narrowing her eyes. "Unlike you, I'm not bound to share my secrets with Iblis. Now give me back my book or pick up your weapon."
"I won't fight you," he shook his head. "Forgive me. I never should have lifted my sword against you."
"Why not?" she bristled. "You don't think me a worthy opponent?"
"You," he said ardently, "have always been too worthy. I will not hurt you."
The Noster burned against her skin. Aliza fought back a shock of feelings then, her heart convoluted, impossible to pass. Struggling to clear her head, she said,
"You don't need to worry about hurting me. I'm quite capable of defending myself."
"Aliza," he whispered, "I would destroy you."
This made her mad. She lunged at him with an angry cry, slicing her sword through the air with brute strength and speed, and still he dodged this and dove for his mace, which had been resting against a nearby couch, and spun around in an instant to meet her next blow, her sword crashing against his staff with astonishing violence. Again she advanced, swinging her blade in a diagonal arc, and again their weapons collided, the sound of metal clanging in her ears. Over and over she attacked. He retreated. She lunged. He evaded. Aliza had the advantage of fleet-footedness and strength, and still Cyrus parried her every move. True, she hadn't used a sword in several years, and as a result her skills were rusty, if not a bit outdated, but her preternatural gifts should have given her an edge. Instead, they only seemed to balance the scales. She didn't understand how Cyrus was so capable or swift, or how he seemed to anticipate her actions. Worse, he did not seem to tire, and he never lifted his weapon except in defense. It was infuriating. Finally, angrily, she held her ground and glared at him. She'd funneled so much effort into the exchange that she was now exhausted, her arms shaking a little, and had to resist the urge to stomp her foot like a child. "Give me back my book," she cried. "It belongs to me."
Cyrus shook his head slowly, staring at her in wonder. His chest was heaving slightly, his voice only a little breathless from his recent efforts.
"Marry me," he said.
Aliza tightened her grip on her weapon, her eyes widening in outrage.
"You think this is funny?"
"I'm not joking.
Give me my book right now, or I swear I'll tear this room apart."
"Aliza," he said, shaking his head. There was a warning in his voice. "Please don't test me."
"Why not?"
She was sincerely asking the question. The longer she stared at his heated eyes, the more she lost confidence in herself.
What are you going to do?"
"Touch my things," he said softly, "and I will physically remove you from this room."
"You wouldn't dare," she said, but weakly, for she didn't know whether he would. "Would you?"
When he only offered her a grim smile in response, Aliza felt a bolt of fear, which she forced aside with great effort. Calmly, she walked over to his desk
and for a moment she studied the many bell jars he'd neatly organized. Tiny labels reading things like cryptocrystalline silica and hexagonal scalenohedral mineral. Then she placed her hand on one of the glass domes. Very politely, she said, "Please give me back my book." He made a sound, something like a growl.
"I can't," he said, frustrated. "You know I can't."
Aliza held his eyes as she knocked the specimen to the floor, where it landed with a crash, glass shattering everywhere. She reached out to knock over another when he said, in a low, lethal voice,
"Stop!"
She knocked over the second one.
"Aliza!"
He said her name like an epithet, the sound lancing through her like a blade. She looked up in time to see that he was advancing toward her now, with a fiendish gleam in his eyes, like he was going to pick her up and throw her over his shoulder and do something, she didn't know what, and she quickly spun around, swinging her sword toward him, pointing it in his direction to keep him where he was. "Don't take another step," she said, panicking just a little. There was something terrifying, yes, but also glorious about Cyrus as he stood there, shirtless and unrepentant, without a weapon, entirely unafraid. She was actually trembling a little. He did not strike her as the kind of person who bluffed.
"You forgot," he said softly,
touching his hand to the blade she pointed at him and making it disappear.
"That I don't fight fair."
Aliza stumbled back and stared in astonishment at her empty hands and then up at him. Cyrus wasted no time closing the distance between them, moving now with unrelenting determination. She hurried backward desperately. "Don't you dare pick me up," she cried, her heart racing in her chest. "I just want what's mine. It's not polite to pick people up against their will." Inches away, Cyrus came to a halt.
"It's not polite," he said, stunned.
"Aliza, it's not polite to break into people's private rooms. It's not polite to tear down people's doors and destroy their things."
"For the 100th time," she said, exasperated. "I broke your door by accident. I was only trying to find a place to hide before the maid walked in."
This gave him pause.
"The maid?"
He frowned.
"You mean the snodder who entered my room,"
he said, pointing in the direction of his room.
"And screamed so loudly in my face she woke me up?"
Aliza nodded.
"When she knocked, I didn't know what to do. I knew I couldn't be found in your bedroom, or it would cause a huge scandal. So I yanked open the first door I found."
"Yanked it open?" he cried. "You practically tore the door off its hinges."
"I know that, and I'm sorry. Sometimes, not often, but sometimes when I'm in a panic, I forget how strong I am and I break things, and I'm very sorry."
She was wringing her hands now.
"I swear I'd fix it if I could, but I've never been any good with carpentry. Though I did once, in one of my other positions, have to mend the legs of a chair I'd accidentally snapped off, and which I managed to repair, luckily, with a rather powerful adhesive, before the housekeeper found out."
At that, the fight seemed to leave his body.
"Aliza," he said, turning away with a sigh, "you don't have to fix my blasted door."
"Nevertheless," she said, swallowing, "while it should be noted that I'm still furious with you for stealing what's mine, I swear I didn't enter this room with malicious intent."
He looked up at her then, a slight line forming between his brows.
"You really mean that?"
"Of course I do."
"So you didn't?" His frown deepened. "You didn't come here tonight with the express purpose of retrieving your book? Or rummaging through my things?"
"No."
"You have no intention of triple-crossing me?"
"What?"
She almost laughed.
"No."
He shook his head, as if trying to clear it.
Then what on earth are you doing here?
I already told you I was running from the maid.
Here, Aliza, he said patiently. Not this room. What are you doing here, in my wing of the castle? All this time I've been operating under the assumption that you snuck in when the maid opened the door. But now I'm just confused.
At that, Aliza went still. She was quiet for a long, tense moment before she said finally,
You don't remember any of it?
29.
Cyrus stared at her, his confusion transforming into something like fear.
Remember any of what?
His stricken expression inspired a pang in her heart, for the insensible organ had no brain and could not be reasoned with. Aliza was angry with him, and still she softened.
You don't remember, she said, what happened in the flower field?
There was a long beat, during which Cyrus averted his eyes, his throat working.
I do remember, he said finally.
What's the last thing you remember?
What do you mean?
He did not look up. Well, do you remember talking to me?
Yes, he whispered.
And then?
And then,
he said, and sighed, looking suddenly intensely uncomfortable.
Then I experienced some pain.
She hated the way he said it. Hated the way his voice hollowed out, as if his suffering were something inconsequential and fleeting, as if it weren't actual torture, as if she hadn't sat there and watched as blood dripped down his closed eyes and into his open, screaming mouth. I think it was a fair amount worse than that, said Aliza.
I don't know what you saw.
A great deal, she said quietly. I saw a great deal. He nodded, a muscle jumping in his jaw. He still wouldn't look at her.
Interesting, he said flatly. I didn't realize you'd seen anything at all.
Aliza hesitated at his tone, not knowing how to interpret his words. I'm sure, she ventured, that I couldn't even begin to imagine the depth of what you suffered. But I was there. I saw everything.
You, he said, attempting a wry smile, were not there.
Aliza actually flinched. She was so surprised. She didn't know whether to react to the fact of his statement being patently false, or whether to wonder at the undertone of an accusation in his voice. That he thought she'd abandoned him was strange enough, but that he was upset about it? Had she somehow managed to hurt Cyrus's feelings? This she struggled to fathom.
Don't misunderstand me, he went on, studying the middle distance. I don't blame you for leaving. In fact, it's quite understandable considering the circumstances, for it must have been not only an unpleasant viewing, but an excellent opportunity to be rid of me.
You have it entirely wrong, she said with some heat. I was there the whole time. Finally, he looked up, perplexed, even as he shook his head.
Why would you challenge this? Aliza, when I came to, you were gone. I brought myself back to the palace alone.
How would I have left? She asked, cutting him off. We were in the middle of nowhere.
I don't know, he said dismissively, as if this were a trivial point. You are not without your own resources. You have supernatural speed. Clearing a couple of miles wouldn't take you very long. And if you walk far enough through the field, there's access to the main road. The castle is quite visible in the distance. I assumed you snuck back in here, only to retrieve your book before running away.
Aliza drew a deep, steadying breath. She knew now that she'd have to prod his memory, and while she suspected that the truth would hurt him, this, him thinking she'd abandoned him in that state, struck her as far worse. If nothing else, her pride couldn't handle it. I never left you, she said, steeling herself. I sat there for 2 hours while you suffered, and I used my own dress to wipe the blood from your face. I begged you to wake up. I begged you to bring us back to the palace. No, he said. No, you... His voice trailed off as he looked at her, really looked at her, his eyes fixing upon the knotted red stain on her gown. Eliza saw him visibly stiffen, the blood draining from his face. Cyrus, she said, I didn't leave you there. He was breathing hard now, his body turning to stone before her. He seemed paralyzed by this revelation, astonished into speechlessness. Finally, he said, That wasn't a dream? No, she whispered. Fucking hell! He pushed a hand through his hair and looked away, his body so tight with tension she worried he might break. What did you think happened?
I thought I was in bed, he choked out. I thought I was sleeping.
But how did you think you got back to bed? She pressed. Who did you think took off your boots or your bloody coat? He shook his head.
In the aftermath of these experiences, I always...
He hesitated.
I often sleep for a time because it takes me a while to recover. Still, I somehow get myself into bed. No matter the circumstances, I manage in the end to take care of myself, even if I can't always remember doing so. It didn't seem important how I got myself in bed, only that I did get myself in bed. I didn't question it.
I see, she whispered.
You were in my room, he said thickly. Because I brought you there.
Yes.
And you...
He looked up, distraught.
You took care of me. You washed the blood from my face.
This was the second time he'd fixated upon this latter point. Once, while delirious, and now again, fully alert. Eliza wasn't sure why. Yes, she said. I used my skirt to mop up the...
No,
he said, and shook his head, as if he was remembering something. He lifted a hand to his cheek, his confusion growing only more apparent.
No, you washed my face.
Eliza frowned. You seem preoccupied with this detail.
It's impossible not to notice the difference, he said, dropping his hand. Even when I manage to wipe away the worst of it, I wake up from these incidents with my eyes all but sealed together by the dregs of dried blood.
Eliza absorbed this admission like a punch to the gut. It was the casual way he said it, the nonchalance with which he described something so gruesome that revealed so much about him. It was confounding to her how he didn't seem to care about the blows he took, that he could speak so easily about his own torture.
I just don't understand, he was saying. How did you wash my face when we had no water?
At that, Eliza felt the prickle of something like embarrassment. How could she put into words an explanation that, when spoken aloud, sounded melodramatic to the extreme? At the time, she'd seen only a person in need. She'd not questioned the impulse to assist. She'd not thought she might be overreacting. Now she wasn't so sure. Nervously, she clasped her hands. I did use my skirt to mop up most of the blood, she said, fixing her eyes firmly on the floor. But then I used the moisture of my tears to scrub away the sticky residue. Cyrus was silent for a frighteningly long beat. When he finally spoke, his voice was soft, his astonishment palpable.
You cried for me?
It has been noted, she whispered, that I perhaps cry too much.
You used your own tears, he said, all but broken, to wash the blood from my face.
To this, Eliza had no glib response.
The earlier prickle of embarrassment had become a full-body mortification as she stood there, her head heating as she listened to him take inventory of her earlier actions. She couldn't bring herself to meet his eyes.
"Eliza, please look at me."
She shook her head at the floor.
"This is quite humiliating for me, Cyrus. I won't look at you."
"Why is it humiliating?"
"Because I was stupid," she said in a sudden burst. "I was kind to you, only to discover that you'd been lying to me all this time, that you'd stolen my book and refused to give it."
The words died in her throat. Eliza had lifted her head as she spoke, anger burning away the worst of her unease, but she was stopped short by the look on Cyrus's face. The anguish in his eyes struck a bolt through her chest.
"Why did you do it?" he said, his voice strained. "Why were you so kind to me? I'd heard someone crying, but I thought the sounds were part of a dream or a hallucination. God, the way you touched me!"
He cut himself off, his expression tortured. He shook his head, dragged a hand across his mouth.
"Eliza, my own mother has never touched me with such tenderness. I didn't think there was any chance you could be real."
She didn't know what to say. Her heart was beating so hard she could hardly hear her own thoughts. Cyrus had looked at her many times since she'd met him, and always with varying levels of intensity, but never quite like this. Never like he wanted to fall to his knees before her. She heard her voice shake a little when she said softly,
"I believe the words you used to describe me were quite charmingly pathetic."
Cyrus exhaled so hard she watched his chest cave a bit. He looked devastated.
"I deserve to be shot for saying that to you."
She managed to smile, but there was no life in it.
"Will you tell me what was happening?" she said instead, hoping to somehow dull the fire in his eyes. "You told me that this always happens to you, that it was part of a cycle."
"Yes," he said, but the word was raw, worn out. "It's medicinal sleep. It always puts me into a strange fog. Afterward, it's the only way to keep me alive."
Eliza paled. "You mean Iblis tortures you nearly to death, and then brings you back from the brink, just to do it again?"
"Yes."
She thought she might be sick. "Does he do this often?"
"Yes,"
he said softly. "How often?"
"It depends."
He swallowed.
"Sometimes twice a week."
She clapped a hand over her mouth and made a sound, something like a sob. Cyrus only looked at her with the same unremitting heat in his eyes, and said nothing. A heavy silence descended between them, the quiet thick with things unspoken. Something had changed in the wake of these revelations, and Eliza wasn't sure she could define it. She knew then only what she saw, and what she saw was a version of Cyrus she'd never seen before. He seemed shaken. What's more, he had touched her, drawn his hands down her body, pressed his lips to her skin, and now they both knew it. Eliza hadn't really allowed herself to think about what had transpired between them, for she'd filed away his delirious words as inadmissible testimony. She'd not thought it fair to consider his drugged actions as evidence of overarching feelings toward her. But the longer he stood there without speaking aloud a retraction, without issuing an apology or denial, the more she wondered whether he stared at her now not with fear, but with longing. He moved slowly then, shattering the silence with his quiet movements, closing the inches between them until the memories of him came back to life with a fever that seared her. She could still hear the crickets, could still see the moonlight on his face. She doubted she'd ever forget the desperate way he'd asked if he could taste her, the sound he'd made when he pressed his face to her breasts. Suddenly she couldn't breathe. He was close now, his eyes bright, burning. She'd never seen such tightly restrained emotion in his face or in the lines of his body. His desire was so potent it was intoxicating. She felt herself tremble under the weight of it. He wanted to touch her. She knew this. She saw it in the rigid control he maintained over his hands, in the stiffness of his stance, in the way he moved incrementally closer until she saw nothing but him. His eyes dropped to her lips, and his own lips parted, drew breath. He exhaled shakily. She worried that if she said a word, she might combust.
"I touched you," he said softly. "Do you remember?"
Aliza's heart was pounding so hard now she actually felt a bit faint. What could she say to his question? The truth was a single word easily delivered, and yet this answer seemed desperately, desperately fraught. She felt it. Felt it even as she said, "Yes, I remember," against his throat. Even then, she knew she was pitching forward into madness. He whispered,
"And do you condemn me for it?"
He tilted his head, his lips almost grazing her cheek, and the harsh sounds of her own shallow breaths grew only more desperate. She didn't know when he'd gotten so close, but he now occupied her senses entirely. The heady scent of his skin, the sight of his naked chest, the sound of his beating heart. She lacked only touch, only taste, and she ached for it. Her mind was gone. She couldn't even remember her own name standing this close to him. She knew dimly that this was a bad idea, that she was playing with fire. But Aliza had survived an inferno once, and she thought she might survive such a blaze again.
"No," she breathed.
She saw a shudder move through him, a heavy exhalation that rocked his frame. He made a desperate, broken sound as he closed his eyes, but still, he didn't touch her. He wouldn't put his hands on her, wouldn't put an end to her torment, and she was far too conflicted even then to claim him for herself.
"Aliza," he whispered, "let me make you my queen."
It was a cold, sharp snap of reality. Aliza stiffened and drew back, her head cleared in an instant, alarm roaring through her body. "Did you?" she said, panicking. "Are you trying to seduce me, to get me to marry you?" Cyrus looked like he'd been struck. He stared at her, his chest heaving, his eyes so plainly devastated she was overcome at once with regret.
"No,"
he said, exhaling the word. The Noster warmed.
"I'm sorry," she cried, shaking her head. "I'm sorry, I know it's a terrible accusation, but
why are you acting like this is a surprise?"
He was recovering slowly, his pain calcifying, heating before her eyes.
"I made my intentions clear from the beginning, Aliza. I want to marry you."
"The devil wants you to marry me," she exploded. "That's not at all the same thing. How can you not see—"
"Marry me," he countered, "and you get your crown. The devil is briefly sated, and I'm discharged in great part of my debt. We all get something we want. Why is that so wrong?"
"It's one thing," she said angrily, "to enter into a false arrangement in the pursuit of our own interests. But this, Cyrus, this wouldn't be false, and it would complicate everything. What were you going to do? If I kissed you, what would come next?"
"I would marry you," he said, stepping closer again, coming dangerously within reach. "I'd marry you tomorrow, and then I'd take you to bed for weeks."
She felt her face heat, her heart pounding recklessly.
It was a shocking thing to say, but more shocking was the way her body reacted to his pronouncement, with a flare of desire she struggled to extinguish. "And then," she said, failing to steady her voice, "you expect me to kill you?" He hesitated.
"That choice is yours to make."
"You're unbelievable," she breathed. "How can you be so cavalier? This is a deathly serious situation."
"And what was your plan?" he said, his eyes flashing. "How did you think this would end?"
"I don't know," she said, and shook her head. I wasn't thinking."
"And now you're thinking too much.
You're being cruel,
and you are needlessly shocked. You've known from the first that I'm yoked to a ruthless master, that in fact I sought you out under his orders, that I disrupted my life and disordered my home and tore myself open at his behest, all for you." He swallowed. "All for you. Do you really not see what you've done to me? In a matter of days, you've stripped me down and upended my world. My hours are in disarray, my future is in chaos, and my head.
He turned away and grimaced, his fists clenching, and Aliza thought her heart might stop.
"And instead of being angry," he went on, "instead of driving you away, instead of wishing we'd never met, I keep staring at that fucking cut on your neck, Aliza, and I want to die."
"Cyrus."
"It's my own fault," he said,
and dragged both hands down his face.
"I have only myself to blame. I knew better. I knew you were dangerous. You've had the upper hand from the moment I laid eyes on you. I saw you and saw right away that I was in hell, and I hated you for it, because I realized even then that you would be the end of me."
"What are you talking about?" she asked, alarmed. "You speak as if I harmed you." He laughed then, laughed like he might be coming unhinged.
"Of course you don't know. Why would you? How could you possibly know the truth? That you've been haunting me for so long, tormenting me every night."
"Cyrus, stop it," she said. "You're not being fair. I never even knew you."
"You don't understand," he said, tortured. "I've been dreaming about you for months."
The Nosta flashed hot against her skin, and Aliza went still. "What?"
"I didn't know who you were," he said, shaking his head. "I didn't know your name. I thought you were only an achievement of my imagination, some kind of conjured fantasy."
Aliza felt stricken, disoriented. Her pounding heart was a disaster. What did you dream about me?"
He only looked away, said nothing.
"Are you not allowed to tell me?"
Cyrus laughed a bleak laugh. "Oh no, this story I'm free to share. I just don't want to."
"Why not?"
"Aliza," he whispered, still refusing to meet her gaze, "spare me a bit of mercy. Don't make me say these things out loud."
"Please," she said urgently. "I don't mean to make you suffer, but I need to understand. If the devil has been planting my likeness in your mind, I must know how he's using me. What did I do to you? Did I hurt you in your imaginings?" It was a moment before Cyrus said, now staring at the wall,
"Far from it. I always thought you were some kind of an angel."
She drew a sharp breath. That word, again. He'd called her angel in his delirium, and now she thought she was beginning to understand.
"It was a long time before I suspected Iblis had anything to do with my dreams," Cyrus was saying. "I see now, of course, that I should have doubted sooner, but you always struck me as far too lovely to be associated with him. So generous, so sweet, so beautiful I could hardly look at you, even in my dreams. I thought my mind had magicked you to life as an antidote to my nightmares. I never dared to believe you might exist in real life."
The Noster continued to substantiate his words, and Aliza grew only more unsteady as she listened. She worried she wouldn't survive this speech.
"When I saw you for the first time before the ball," he went on, "I finally understood. You have no idea how you unbalanced me then. How could you know how it terrified me to look at you, when I realized the devil had done this to me on purpose, that he'd taken a reverie I'd come to cherish and twisted it, tainted it with his darkness?"
"I don't understand," she said desperately. "Why does Iblis torture you so much? Why would he do such a thing?"
Cyrus finally looked up, meeting her eyes with a force of emotion so intense, Aliza felt the Noster burn against her skin, verifying something he hadn't even spoken aloud. It shocked her.
"I made the devil the only oath he would accept," Cyrus said softly, "the terms of which are damning indeed. If I renege on our agreement at any point in any way, my life will be his to control forevermore. Often I think he made me this bargain because he felt certain I would break under the weight of it. Iblis would much prefer the convenience of an utterly loyal subject, for either way, he'd get what he wanted from me. I think it's why he so often torments me, pushing me too far. He'd planted you in my mind with the express purpose of destroying me emotionally, undercutting me, stripping me of my defences, so that I'd be unprepared when we met." He laughed, and the sound was bitter. "No doubt he hoped that upon discovering your identity I'd release you at once, and in the process, lose everything." Aliza's eyes burned with tears as he spoke. There was no other way to describe it. Her heart was breaking. "I didn't trust you," Cyrus said quietly. "How could I trust you? You were a vision conjured by the devil, designed to ruin me. I hated you for being real, for coming to life only to personify torture, to be another trial to endure. In fact, I wanted to hate you. I wanted to discover your faults, your flaws. I thought you'd never match up to the figment of my dreams. And I was wrong. You are far more enchanting in real life, far more exquisite." His voice shook just a little when he said softly, "It is excruciating to be in your presence."
Again the Noster seared her skin. Aliza wanted to sit down. She wanted a glass of water. She wanted to submerge herself in a cold bath. She could only bring herself to say his name.
"I knew, somehow, that it would come to this," he said, looking away. "I just thought I was stronger. I thought it would take longer. Instead, you've managed to sever me in half with astonishing speed."
"You're being unfair," she said, forcing herself to speak, her heart beating painfully in her chest. "You act as if I'm intentionally cruel, as if I'm indifferent to you, aren't you?"
"No,"
she whispered, her eyes filling with tears.
"Of course not."
Cyrus stared at her from where he stood, his chest heaving with barely leashed intensity. He devastated her with that look, even as he seemed planted in the ground, immovable.
"Then be with me," he said softly. "Let me worship you."
"Oh, don't do this," she said, wiping angrily at her eyes. "This path is too perilous already, and we both know it. Don't speak of things you cannot give me."
"You have no idea what I could give you," he said, his own eyes blazing. "You have no idea what I want. I have been in agony for 8 months, Aliza. Do you know how hard it's been to pretend I don't know you? To pretend I don't want you? To act as if I haven't known every inch of your body in my dreams? To learn that your heart has been entangled elsewhere? I look at you and I can't breathe. In my mind, you are already mine."
"Stop," she said, struggling now to catch her breath. "Don't talk to me like this. This is dangerous, Cyrus.
Then why tell me you care? He countered. Why tell me you feel something only to dismiss me? Do you think it's easy for me to stand here before you and speak so candidly? Do you think me a masochist? Do you think I enjoy this pain?
How can you be so self-pitying? She said miserably. How can you blame me for the movements of your own heart? How can you hold me accountable for your misfortunes, even as you hold hostage my belongings, as you plot and murder under the orders of a despicable beast? I understand your turmoil, Cyrus. Really, I do. I am not without compassion. I saw enough of your suffering tonight to imagine how wretched you must be. But how can you ask me to trust you with my heart when you still keep secrets from me? When you are beholden to the darkest creature alive, forsaking all others for him, placing his wishes, his demands above all else? She shook her head. No, I could never be with you, she said. Not because I am indifferent, but because you could never be faithful to me. You could never choose me first, and you should not blame me for my fears. He went quite still then, doing nothing to mask the agony printed upon his face.
I might, one day, be free.
Maybe, she allowed. Until then, you could not know what he might ask of you. You might break me just to please him. When he did not deny this, when he only looked at her like he wanted to drive a dagger through his chest, she had her answer. Where does this leave us, then? She whispered. Will you rescind your offer of marriage? He laughed, and it was tragic.
How I wish I could.
Then I need you to know, she said, summoning her courage, that despite everything, I might still accept, in the interest of my own future.
Her words nearly broke him.
She saw it in his eyes, in the sudden fall of his shoulders, in the way his arms fell heavily at his sides.
After all this, after everything I've shared with you tonight, you would become my wife, he said, his voice ragged. In title only?
Yes, she said quietly.
You wouldn't touch me or laugh with me. You wouldn't share my bed.
Her heart was beating in her throat. No.
Aliza, you would make me the most wretched man alive.
I'm sorry, she said, shaking her head as she spoke. I'm desperately sorry. Her feeble heart was splintering in her chest, and she fought frantically against the ache of it, struggling to hold her ground. She, too, had a path she was meant to follow. It's just that your arguments, she said haltingly, your reasoning, the picture you drew, it was undeniably compelling. I've been turning over the possibility in my mind all day, and while I haven't made my decision yet, I know that if I ever hope to have a chance of leading my people, of fulfilling my destiny, I will require an empire.
And then, he said softly, will you kill me then? Is this the order in which you intend to annihilate me? Will you tear out my heart first, rip off my crown next, and end my life only when I'm on my knees, begging you to end my misery?
Cyrus, she said desperately, please. She was losing the battle with her tears and struggled to fight back the flood. I never asked for any of this. All I ever wanted from the world was to disappear. You brought me here. You made me this offer. You gave me the opportunity to see what I might be, and I can't willfully blind myself to the possibility now. Not now that I know there are people out there waiting for me. Not when I, too, have a duty.
I am well aware, he said, lowering his eyes, of how I did this to myself. You need not bury the blade any deeper. His voice quieted then to something less than a whisper.
But will you promise me something, Angel? When you do decide to kill me, will you tell me how you intend to do it?
Cyrus.
Enough. I beg you.
He shook his head.
I'm only a man, Aliza. I can only withstand so much torture in one day. Please, he said, his voice breaking on the word. Leave me. Leave me to what's left of my godforsaken life.
She stood there a moment, frozen.
And tomorrow? She said quietly. Who will we become then? Are we to be enemies once more?
He said nothing, his body trembling almost imperceptibly as he stared at the ground, and when he finally parted his lips to answer, there came a sudden urgent pounding at the door.
30.
Cyrus stiffened, but he did not move. Neither of them said a word. Aliza was still staring at his mouth, wishing the world beyond these walls would drop dead just long enough for her to know his answer. But her hopes were soon dashed. There was another round of relentless pounding at the door, and finally Cyrus closed his eyes and swore, drawing away from her with palpable anguish. Aliza stood there, paralyzed in place, her mind spinning, her heart broken. She heard his footfalls as he strode to the entrance, heard the whine of the old wood as he opened the door. Sarah's voice was unmistakable.
Where have you been? She screamed. I've been searching for you everywhere. Your valet said he'd come up earlier to dress you for dinner, but he claimed you weren't here. And then you never appeared downstairs, and neither did the girl who wasn't in her room. And I had no idea where to even begin looking for you. For the last place I expected you to be so early in the evening was lying unconscious in your bed like some kind of profligate. Not until my maid told me she'd heard about the most miserable snodder sobbing her eyes out in the kitchens, fearing for her job after finding you asleep in your chamber. Mother! And why aren't you wearing any clothes? Heavens, but you look worse than death. Have you been ill? Is that why you were abed at this hour?
Yes.
Your timing, she said angrily, is disastrous. It's just like you to go and get yourself sick when you're actually needed, begging off when everyone else has to deal with the fallout of your demented actions.
Aliza was astonished. She knew the grim extent to which Sarah loathed her son. And within the context of the woman's injured mind, Aliza could indeed understand her emotional conflict, for she rightfully blamed Cyrus for the brutal murder of her husband. Still, even knowing this, it was shocking to hear her hatred animated thus. It was unnatural to listen to a mother berate her son for falling ill, never bothering to ask whether he was okay. There was something so painful about the exchange that it was hard to hear.
Will you not get to your point? Cyrus was saying, his voice clipped. What is it you need from me?
I need that girl, Sarah shrieked. Where is she? Where is Aliza? What have you done with her?
Aliza felt a sudden spike of alarm.
What have I done with her?
Cyrus laughed, but it sounded angry.
Don't take that tone with me, as if I haven't every reason to doubt you. The girl is not in her rooms. What else am I supposed to think? No one has seen her in hours. No one save every djinn in Tulan, she added hysterically, who've been arriving in terrifying hordes from every reach of the Empire, and who stormed the castle an hour ago.
Aliza felt her heart stop.
What?
Now Cyrus sounded alarmed.
What do you mean? Are they being violent?
Yes, they're being violent, she cried. What on earth can you think I mean? There are thousands of them, Cyrus,
and they're threatening to break down the door lest she show herself.
I don't understand, he said, his urgency escalating. Why are they angry? I thought they loved her.
Then you knew, she said, overwrought. You knew who she was? You knew she meant something to them?
Oh, Cyrus, how could you?
Sarah sounded truly broken then.
Of all the stupid and terrible things you've ever done. You told me she was of royal blood, but you didn't tell me she was this messiah. She's going to tear apart the empire.
Aliza felt dizzy now, her breaths growing only faster, more laboured. She couldn't believe this was happening. More than that, she couldn't believe after all these years that it was happening like this. It was a disaster.
What are they demanding? Cyrus asked coldly. Why did you bring her here? Sarah said, and practically sobbed. Why have you wrought such havoc upon our home? Do you not see what will become of us? More djinn will hear of her and they'll come for her. They'll crawl out of every dark corner of the earth, she gasped. And we'll have to wage war against our own people.
Mother, he said sharply,
get a hold of yourself.
You are a blight upon this family, she cried. You are a stain upon the earth.
What do they want from her? He said,
his voice shaking with fury.
What are their demands?
They want proof that she's real, and they want to know she's unharmed. Most of all, they want to know whether she's come here to marry you, whether she will take the throne.
Aliza gasped, clasped a hand to her throat.
Cyrus was briefly silent. He was subdued when he said finally,
Do they want her to marry me?
I don't know, Sarah exploded, sounding unhinged. All I know is that they're threatening to set the city on fire if she doesn't show herself soon, and I can't find her anywhere.
I'll find her, he said roughly.
And even then, Aliza knew he was protecting her. Cyrus knew she hadn't wanted to be found in a compromising position with him, in his bedroom, and the small gesture meant a great deal to her. But she was slowly realizing there was no use. She could not hide forever.
Where are you going to find her? Sarah shouted. You know where she is? You've known this whole time, and you've just been torturing me?
First, Cyrus said, ignoring his mother's outburst. You must get them to calm down. I can't let her stand before this mob until I'm sure she can be safe.
You ask them to calm down, Sarah shot back. You think I haven't been trying? They won't listen to me.
Her reputation be damned. Aliza could no longer stand there silently. These were her people. And they were her responsibility. And she knew that if her parents were here, they'd tell her to come into the light. They'd tell her not to be afraid. Her heart pounding desperately in her chest, Aliza held her head just above the rising waters of terror and stepped out of the shadows.
31.
Kamran had been standing there for at least 20 minutes already, staring at the sky with a fragile, fracturing hope. He'd tucked the scrap of paper back into the box, and the box back into his cloak pocket, but the feather, now marred by his blood, was still clutched in his fist. His mind was a maelstrom of warring emotions, upended by the inconceivable evidence that his beloved diviners had known, days and days before they were murdered, not only that King Zal would die, but how Kamran would suffer. It made his heart ache. He marvelled at how certain the priests and priestesses had been of his movements and actions. Kamran was now in possession of a piece of his grandfather's will, and had he opened this parcel but a day sooner, he would have been shocked. Yes, but also confused and devastated. He might have used the feather too soon or at the wrong time.
Worse, the slim box could have been easily lost, misplaced, handled incorrectly. And yet, the diviners hadn't worried. All had happened precisely as they'd foreseen. He'd mistakenly assumed that the new crop of diviners had betrayed him by tossing him into the tower. He saw now that they'd been protecting him, locking him somewhere Zahark might not reach him, and leaving him high enough in the sky so that Simorgh might come to him easily. What he didn't know, of course, was which part of all this was meant to be a test. He didn't know what exactly he was meant to prove, or how he might prove it, but he saw now that they had known his plan. They must have known he was heading to Tulan, for the gift of Simorgh, the exalted character he'd heard so much about in childhood, about whose kindness and generosity Zal had told endless stories, was a gift of transportation and protection. Kamran knew he could ride upon her back, that she would carry him where he needed to go, that she would offer him her armour and her companionship. Simorgh was beloved by many, but especially Ardunians, who believed she still lived here with her family, but who hadn't been spotted since the day Zal was returned to the palace in a triumphant moment, blazing through the sky on the back of this brilliant, ethereal creature. And now, here stood Kamran, presented with a possible exit from the madness of his life, an opportunity to ally with the most legendary magical beast in the history of his world, and he didn't even know whether Simorgh would come. Kamran had no idea whether he'd done the deed right, or how long it might take the magnificent bird to find him. Hours? Days? Would he freeze to death until then? Was she even alive after all this time? It occurred to Kamran that he might keep warm by searching the floor of this filthy tower for a pair of rocks he might strike together against a pile of dead leaves. And while he wasn't beyond searching the decrepit depths of this cell with his bare hands, he did hesitate at the thought, hoping then for a third option, preferably something more like divine intervention, or... He heard the sudden thunder of harried footsteps, the swell of agitated voices. Kamran! Kamran, are you in there? There was a violent pounding against the metal door, and the prince was so stunned by this unexpected clamour that he struggled to rouse himself from his thoughts. Indeed, he'd hardly a moment to gather his wits before he saw a soft, gleaming light fall steadily from the sky above him. He'd been so consumed by silence and strangeness all this time that he thought for a moment he might be imagining things, just until he heard a growing buzz as the soft light approached, the little glow flickering as, without warning, it bopped gently against his face. Hazan's firefly. Kamran was overcome. He'd never felt such elation or relief. He thought he might fall to his knees with the heft of it. Instead, he said, quite calmly, "What took you so long?" Hazan, in response, broke down the door. The rusted metal panel made a deafening groan as it was knocked free from its frame, the hinges screeching as they were torn apart. Kamran moved quickly out of the obstacle's path, the entire cell shuddering as the weighty door hit the ground with a reverberant crash. Once he felt it was safe, Kamran moved forward to clasp hands with his friend, to thank him for what he'd done. And instead, he recoiled so intensely he nearly tripped over the rotting lump of something extremely dead. "Your Highness?" Miss Hooda peered through the open doorway. "Are you quite well?"
"He's alive!" Omid cried, and tackled Kamran in a show of affection, for which, just days ago, he might have been sentenced to death. "You're alive!"
"Good God!" said Dean, roughly yanking Omid away from the prince.
Extricate yourself at once, boy. What are you thinking? One does not simply hug the Prince of Ardunia.
I'm sorry, Omid said breathlessly. I'm terribly sorry, sire. It's only that I'm just so happy to see you. I thought for sure the Defence Minister had done something terrible to you.
Oh, yes, he's spitting mad, Miss Hooda added, nodding eagerly. He's going around screaming at everyone, even the diviners. I've never seen servants so spooked, and that's saying quite a lot, for Mother can be unforgivably harsh with the staff.
Kamran stood there, staring at this circus, in a state of shock. He'd heard their voices in his mind earlier. He knew that they'd been discussing him, wondering about his whereabouts, but he hadn't thought they'd make up his rescue party.
What? He said, hardly able to speak. On Earth? Are you lot doing here? Obviously. I came to save you, you idiot, said Hazan. I was fairly close to the castle, stockpiling weapons to crate for the journey, when my Firefly found me. I'd left her at the palace to keep an eye on things in my absence, and she alerted me to your situation as soon as Zahark showed up. I came as swiftly as I could. I'm not asking about you, Kamran said dismissively. Of course you're here, and I'm very glad about it, thank you for coming. Really, I mean that. I'm asking about these three.
Oh, said Hazan, and Kamran heard the frown in his voice. Yes, isn't it sweet? They insisted on helping me rescue you.
What? Why?
Well, we saw that you were in danger, sire, said Omid. It was a terrible betrayal. I didn't think the diviners would ever use such awful magic on you. And we weren't going to stand there and let the rightful king be dragged away, cried Miss Hooda, so that some serpent of a minister could steal your crown. My father detests Zahark, and I know this for a fact, because when father is in his cups, he often lists the people he loathes, and the defence minister numbers high on that list, which is fairly long, actually. Miss Hooda frowned. I hadn't really thought about it until just now.
And you? Kamran turned on the apothecarist. What's your excuse?
Oh, I haven't the faintest idea, Your Highness, said Dean, looking about the tower with a visible revulsion. That awful housekeeper was horrified by the idea of taking part in any of this, and I was stupid enough to agree with her out loud. She then demanded I be a gentleman and walk her the half mile down the bridge, so she might hail a cab on a busier corner in town, the fare of which, she suggested, we share. He sighed. I think I might have said yes to these blockheads, he nodded at Omid and Miss Hooda, simply to avoid being alone with her. Though with all due respect, sire, I find I'm regretting that decision now.
I see, said Kamran, frowning.
Come on then, Hazan said, clapping the prince on the shoulder. Let's get you out of this hellhole. We'll have to make a run for it straight away. Zahark is on a rampage. He's tearing apart the castle looking for you, and for something else. Your grandfather's will, it sounded like.
Kamran felt a bolt of fear.
And I suggest we head to the docks without delay. There's a great deal I need to tell you, and then we need to come up with a plan.
A great deal you need to tell me?
Kamran's alarm intensified.
About what?
Hazan almost smiled. I ran into your mother.
What? Where?
Hazan nodded toward the exit.
Never mind that now. We'll have plenty of time to talk and plot while we're on the water.
On the water? Said Miss Hooda, her head swivelling between them. Are we getting on a boat?
Not you, said Kamran and Hazan at the same time.
Hazan, the prince said, shaking his head as he glanced again at the skylight. I can't leave yet. I have to stay here at least a while longer.
What?
Hazan recoiled.
Why would you want to stay here? You're standing next to a matted pile of rats.
Miss Hooda shrieked. Oh, God, Dean whispered.
I think I'm going to be sick.
They're not rats, said Omid helpfully, in a broken accent. Well, they're not only rats. There's also a possum, I think, and, the other one I can't remember the name in our duns.
Miss Hooda shrieked again.
Kamran paid this no mind. He was about to hold out his hand to Hazan, to show him the feather clutched in his fist, the parcel tucked into his pocket, when suddenly the night was torn asunder by a beautiful, terrifying cry. Kamran could not see her, not at first, for the astonishing bird was blocked from view by the mostly enclosed roof, but he felt his bleeding hand heat against the feather he still clutched, and he knew in his bones that she'd arrived. The tower prison shuddered as she alighted, and he was struck by the force of her power, the strength she wielded even now when he couldn't see her. He saw the shadow of an enormous talon through the skylight, and in a series of violent, elegant motions, she crushed the roof of the prison with her claws. Pulverized rock came raining down on their heads, and the group of them bolted from the room to avoid the catastrophic shower, returning only when all was quiet, and when, through the clearing dust storm, Simorgh appeared as if out of a dream. She was magnificent. Kamran moved forward as the others drew back, and he fell on one knee before her. Broad and gleaming, Simorgh spanned the width of the entire room, her downy glimmering feathers a muted starburst of colour in the moonlight. She canted her head and regarded him with dark, inky eyes a long time before she finally nodded in a simple acknowledgement that set Kamran's heart to flutter. She made a sound, a warble soft and tender, then dropped to her knees so that he might scale her back. Kamran felt his breath catch in his chest.
Simorgh, Hazan whispered. Heavens above, Dean gasped. I never thought in all my life.
Am I dreaming? Said Miss Hooda. I think I might be dreaming.
Yes, miss, said a dazed Omid.
You are.
Hazan stepped forward and bowed before the bird, who only studied him curiously. The former minister rose incrementally, his body rigid with astonishment, as he turned to the prince.
Kamran, how did you?
I promise, said Kamran. I'll explain everything later. But if the situation is as dire as you say, we better get going.
Get going?
Hazan's eyes widened.
To Toulon, you mean?
Yes.
With Simorgh?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. We're going to Toulon? Cried Miss Hooda. Are we going to save Aliza?
Again Kamran flinched at the sound of her name. He didn't dignify Miss Hooda's question with a response.
Take these, Hazan said to the prince, pulling a strap over his head. I grabbed a few weapons from the stockpile before I left. I didn't know if I'd need them. But if we'll be entering Toulon from on high, best to have them at the ready, just in case.
He tossed Kamran a quiver of arrows and then a bow, both of which his friend caught easily and slung quickly over his back.
Thank you, said the prince. Truly.
Hazan only looked at Kamran a moment, then responded with a firm nod.
Could I have something too? Said Omid, who was approaching Hazan with an eagerness Kamran found unnerving. I don't have any weapons, and I'd like to be armed. Oh, and I as well, cried Miss Hooda. Do you happen to have any throwing stars? I'm quite good with throwing stars.
You can't be serious, Kamran said, horrified. The two of you are not coming with us.
Three,
Dean cleared his throat, sounding suddenly quite peppy.
There are three of us, actually.
I thought you had to get home,
Kamran said darkly, turning to face the apothecarist.
I thought you said you had loved ones waiting for you, that you had no idea what you were doing here.
That was before I knew I was going to meet Simorgh, said Dean, who quickly bent in half when the bird turned to look at him. My loved ones will understand, if they even believe me. He stared at the bird in wonder. I can't go home now. Kamran shook his head. Are you all blind? He cried. There are five of us. We can't all five of us fit on the back of the same bird. Simorgh made a call. It was a gentle, melodious sound, but it carried nonetheless, and in a moment Kamran realized they were not alone. Simorgh had brought others, the children Zal had known in youth, whose nest he'd shared as a babe. Four more magnificent birds alighted at the top of the tower, the group of them peering down into the dark, trilling softly. Briefly, Kamran closed his eyes. Oh, for heaven's sake, he muttered. Dean whooped. If you choose to come, you're coming under your own command, Kamran said sharply. Get yourselves killed and I won't be bothered. Is that clear? Yes, cried Omid, pumping a fist in the air. Get ourselves killed? Dean frowned. I didn't realize we might die.
No, sire, said Miss Hooda, shaking her head. With all due respect, Your Highness, I don't think that's very responsible of you, for we shall require a leader, and you were quite literally born for such a role.
Hazan, Kamran said, pinching his nose. Miss Hooda, his old minister said quietly, you may rely upon me, should you require anything. Simorgh launched upward then with a resonant cry, landing heavily at the broken lip of the tower, which trembled under her weight. She then chirruped to her children, who landed one at a time in the round cell, loading passengers one by one. Miss Hooda first, laughing through her tears, then Omid, who hugged his bird like the child he was, unself-consciously kissing its feathered face. Then Dean, too proud to betray more than a small, delighted smile as he mounted, even as he fought an obvious swell of emotion. And then Hazan, tall and dignified, he took his seat with the humility and grace befitting a knight, nodding just once at Kamran before he ascended, with a great flap of wings, into the sky. When finally the others were settled among the clouds, Simorgh landed once more before the prince, and Kamran approached the beautiful bird in awe. He drew his hands along her silky feathers with great reverence, then mounted the incredible creature with care. She took off at once. Kamran was forced backward as they ascended, and quickly hooked his arms around the bird's graceful neck as they rose higher and higher up the destroyed spire. And once they loomed above the palace, Simorgh made a cry that wrenched open the night, flapped her powerful shimmering wings, and assumed her place at the head of the pack. There was a thunderous crack as she took off, and a shower of colour streaked across the sky, painting the heavens in an otherworldly phosphorescence. The sight filled him with a complicated joy. Kamran looked back as they vanished into inky skies, wondering, with a quiver in his heart, who he might be if he ever returned. That was These Infinite Threads by Tahereh Mafi, read by Kate Redding, produced by John Marshall Media. Executive producer, Almeda Bainan. An Electric Monkey audiobook, an imprint of HarperCollins. Text copyright, Tahereh Mafi, 2023. Production copyright, HarperCollins Publishers, 2023. All rights reserved. Tahereh Mafi asserts the moral right to be identified as the author of this work. Thank you for listening.